Good evening, everyone. My name is Gareth Russell, and I'm going to be talking to you this evening about Henry VIII's third wife, Jane Seymour. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the talk, and also Claire and Tim for asking me to do this. I've worked with Claire and Tim for a few years now. I first worked with them when I helped lead the Executed Queens tour back in June 2012, I think, and then the Anne Boleyn experience in September 2012, the same year. And yes, I'm sure they're heartily sick of me. They also published my first two novels, Popular and The Immaculate Deception, which are contemporary sort of comedy fiction. So I will be talking about something a little bit more up to date this evening. It is Jane Seymour, Edward VI's mother, and what went through my head when I offered to do a talk on Jane. I helped pick the topic. Was wondering, will I have enough to say for a substantial talk? And that perhaps sounds sort of utterly ridiculous to say that of a Queen of England. But there is a pervasive view of Jane that many of us have, that that she wasn't interesting or that she didn't matter. And I'm going to go through a little bit about her life and her reputation, and to talk about how fair I think those views of her are. It's a lovely autumnal evening in Northern Ireland. I'll show you it. There we are. Lovely, lovely day. By the time you are getting a chance to view this video, it could be December. And so, if we're lucky, it will be a frost-speckled December when you're looking at this, but more often than not, where I am now will be soaked with rain, because it's Ireland and that's how things roll for us the minute it passes out of summer. So, my first introduction to Jane Seymour, and in fact actually my first introduction to Tudor history at all, came through the rain, the Irish rain. We were in the far south, it was in a family holiday, we were rained into our holiday house, and RTE, who are the Irish national broadcasters, showed a rerun of that wonderful Richard Burton and Genevieve Bujold film, Anne of the Thousand Days. And in that film, Jane is dismissed with what I think is one of the best put-downs in movie history. She has the face of a simpering sheep, she has the manners, but not the morals. So Jane Seymour, the crowned sheep, is a view that has lasted in certain circles. In 1972, I think, or 73, a few years after Anne of the Thousand Days was released and earned a very well-deserved Oscar nomination for its female and male leads, Marie-Louise Bruce produced a biography of Anne Boleyn in which I think, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, so forgive me if it's incorrect, she said that Jane Seymour was the least remarkable woman ever to play a significant role in English history. She was born, and it's, you know, we don't know for certain where, but she was probably born at Wolfe Hall, which was her family's country estate, an estate that has now obviously become world famous thanks to Hilary Mantel's Yusuvat Essay. It's the title for her award-winning novel about Thomas Cromwell. And her family were members of the gentry, and that is an important role in early modern society. It's an underrated role. The gentry were still enormously significant to the exercise of authority and the maintenance of law and order. And what we mean by that is that the aristocracy and the monarchy trickled their commands downwards. It was so important in an age of inefficient communication for you to have a reliable upper class who could deal with the exercise of politics in a devolved local level. So Jane Seymour, the daughter of Sir John Seymour and his wife Margaret, is born into the upper classes. She's certainly, in the way that we would understand it, a member of the elite. But she was also destined to become the first queen consort in English history whose father was not at least already an earl or expected to become one. Elizabeth Woodville, Anne Neville and Anne Boleyn were all, you know, they were the daughters of earls or men who were expected to get one, as happened in Elizabeth's case. And we know very little about Jane's early life. We do know that when she was fairly young, she was installed at court as a maid of honour to Catherine of Aragon at the tail end of Catherine's time as queen. It looks as if Jane was there in sort of the late 1520s, early 1530s, and that when Catherine was moved from court in 1531, Jane probably went home because her resources were cut. There's very little documentary evidence about Jane. There is a story that she was at one point considered a potential bride for a member of the Dormer family, and that the matriarch of the Dormer family rejected her because her ancestry wasn't sufficiently exalted. It's hard to know how true that was. The only thing I would say in that anecdote's defence is that it is unusual, given that Jane seems to have been the eldest of the Seymour sisters, that she was not married by 1536, but her younger sister Elizabeth had been. That is still fairly unusual in Tudor times for a younger sister to be married off before the elder one. So maybe there was a failed romance, or maybe the family had expected the Dormer match to go ahead, began to focus on Elizabeth. Elizabeth did go ahead, and the negotiations to marry Jane to a Dormer boy fell through. Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn visit Wolf Hall during their progress. Henry seems very smitten with Jane Seymour, according to later legends. But again, we know very little of the early stages of their relationship. She bursts onto the documentary stage, such as it were. A documentary stage sounds like a hideously boring place to burst onto. But she arrives on it, on the pages of our national history, when Anne Boleyn allegedly blames her for inducing her fateful miscarriage in January 1536. She allegedly caught Henry and Jane in an intimate moment. She might have been in his lap, we don't know. And she publicly or semi-publicly accused her husband of inducing the death of their son through those actions. Jane then resists Henry's attempts to seduce her. She sends back gifts of money. She kisses letters, returns them unopened, says she can't accept any money from him unless he's going to contribute to her dowry to find her a husband. And this all strikes, certainly to me, I can see why certain historians have claimed that this is a manipulative ploy, that this is Jane behaving with far more kind of ruthless cunning, playing with her virtue as bait, far more so than Anne Boleyn or Elizabeth Woodville ever had. And yet at the same time, I can also understand why more sympathetic writers would say, well, we don't know, you know, did she know that the Boleyn queenship was running so close to its end? Did she hope to take Anne Boleyn's place? Or did she think that it was extremely unlikely that the daughter of a knight would be able to displace someone who was the niece of the Duke of Norfolk, the daughter of the Earl of Ormond and Wiltshire, related by blood to most of the great families of the English and certainly the Irish aristocracy? And also the mother of the king's eldest legitimate daughter. Did that strike her as an impossible mountain? Are we being too harsh on Jane with the benefit of hindsight? I don't know. I can certainly see room for the legitimacy of both arguments of how we're interpreting her behaviour. It may have been both. It may have been on the one hand that she hoped to become queen, that her backers, I mean certain people like Sir Nicholas Carew, who was a close friend of the king, seemed to have been helping her in those crucial months. But we just don't No, unfortunately. And we do need to be careful of letting hindsight write too much of our history for us, or letting our own smug paranoia or sort of, I don't know, let's not raise too many eyebrows in history, I think, is always a good angle to take. There's a particularly unlovely imagery that's conjured up in Agnes Strickland's 19th century bestsellers, The Lives of the Queens of England. And she really tears Jane to shreds in her chapter on Jane's career. She evokes this sort of grotesque imagery of Jane picking out her wedding dress at the same time as Anne Boleyn is picking out the dress to wear to her execution, of the sword for Anne's neck being sharpened at the same time as Jane's wedding cake is being made. She refers to Henry as a regal ruffian. She all but describes Jane as processing towards her wedding, ankle deep in Anne Boleyn's blood. It's such a powerful moment, isn't it, to think of that? And it is difficult not to read it and feel sort of revolted nausea at the circumstances in which Jane Seymour became Queen of England. Yet, again, Jane's innermost thoughts are a mystery to us. Did she believe Anne was guilty? Did she choose to believe she was guilty? It seems remarkable to us that someone who was in Anne Boleyn's household, even if it was only for a short time, between 1535 and 1536, could possibly have believed the charges against her. We know from Sir Edward Baynton, who was Anne Boleyn's vice chamberlain, that none of Anne's ladies-in-waiting or her maids would testify against her. They openly told Baynton, no man will confess anything against her. There's nothing to confess, being the subtext. They tried very hard to bully one of Anne's favourite maids, Marjorie Horseman, into testifying against her. No one would budge. So we have to assume that given her company and given her proximity to Anne's ladies-in-waiting in the days preceding her death, that Jane would have known on some level what many people knew for certainty, that Anne Boleyn was the victim of a frighteningly grotesque miscarriage of justice in May 1536. The penultimate day of the month was Jane's wedding day. And her family certainly reaped the benefits of her ascent to queenship. Now, I would argue that the Seymour family were actually far more tenacious and clever, and certainly climbed a lot farther after Jane's death. Her eldest brother, Edward Seymour, who was himself sort of 16th century lingo creeping in. Her eldest brother, Edward, who was himself very unhappily married to Catherine Philall, and then later to Anne Seymour, to whom he was much more happily married, although nobody else found it a particularly happy combination. Edward is a superb social climber. I would say he's on a par with Thomas Cromwell. He really climbs from being the son of a knight to being a viscount, to being an earl, and then ultimately in the reign of his nephew to being Duke and Lord Protector of the realm. Initially, the Seymours strike me as a perfect example of a core Tudor governmental policy that Henry VII started, that Henry VIII carries on, and it's for creating new men. Even the Boleyns, who owed so much to Henry's patronage, and Henry certainly liked to remind Anne, you're my creation. Even that, I think, even that family, that clan, still had enough links to the blue bloods of the old aristocracy in England and in Ireland that they could claim to have an antique ancestry of their own that made them noble in their own right. The Seymours did not quite have those connections, and so the Tudor government's policy of creating new men, new families who were totally dependent on them for favour, therefore totally loyal to the monarchy, and not pursuing any dangerous agendas of their own, that's something that I think the Seymour family exemplified better than anybody else. The Dudley family certainly did so as well, and Elizabeth I is equally fond of this policy, in many ways, given what had happened during the Wars of the Roses, and with the Duke of Buckingham's intrigues against Henry VIII earlier in the reign. It makes shrewd common sense to be doing this. So, the Seymours are a brand new creation. They're totally dependent on Henry, and we see quite nasty examples of this royal absolutism playing out in Jane's marriage. Lauren Mackey's book, Inside the Tudor Court, takes a really interesting interpretation on Jane's first meeting with the Habsburg ambassador, in which his letters home to the Emperor Charles V compliment Jane on her tact, on her intelligence, and even on her elegance and dignity. And that's something I think we have to allow Jane, because she was actually an extremely controlling, almost nightmarish boss. I mean, it's not quite the Devil Wears Prada level, but there are examples of her really quite nastily ticking off servants who are wearing too many buttons, too many pearls, French-style fashions. She really micromanages her servants. And I think this is all to do with a parvenu, a social climber, someone who was one of the club, who's now queen and is now clever enough, astute enough, and determined enough to know that she has to control her other women. She has to push them down to make herself stand on top as queen. That's not a particularly pleasant, soft, or lovely aspect, but I do think it's clever and I think it's essential. And uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. I think she absolutely had to put herself in that position, and she was very, very good at controlling her household. So certainly not a bimbo and not a pushover by any stretch of the imagination. But to get back to her first audience with the Spanish or the Imperial ambassador, he said that when she began to talk at length, Henry interrupts her. Henry sort of claims that she's too tired, that she's a bit overwhelmed by her new responsibilities as queen. And Lauren argues in her book, and I agree actually, that in fact what this reads as is Henry shunting her to one side. The minute she began to show too much intelligence, too much chutzpah, too much determination, he says, oh dear, you're a little tired, she can't talk anymore. That's a very controlling relationship. And we know from later in the marriage, when she tried to offer the king advice on how to deal with an uprising against him, the Pilgrimage of Grace, that he actually flung Anne Boleyn's fate in her face and said, basically, you're trying to meddle in politics. My last wife meddled in politics, and look what happened to her. Which is appalling mental cruelty. I mean, I murdered my last wife, don't forget that. We shouldn't put too many air fresheners on Henry VIII's skills or lack thereof as a husband. He also is not above really bullying later wives, and we see that with Catherine Parr when she gets a little bit too clever, answers back too often. So if we don't always get aspects of Jane, it may be because she knew that she couldn't. And this I'd just like to bring on to something else about Jane's reputation. I don't believe Jane Seymour was how Strickland presented her. I don't believe that at all. I don't think she was cruel. I don't think she was, Strickland didn't know the word, but how Jane Seymour emerges from those kind of very pro-Boleyn 19th century histories is essentially as a sociopath. I don't think that's fair by any stretch of the imagination. But what I do think is that it is an interesting reflection on our cultural values that in the absence of her doing bad, we assume that she did good because she was so quiet, because she was so quiescent, because she was so theatrically submissive to her husband, and I think she had to be. We assume that that lack of action is evidence of good. And I would argue, and we're straying sort of into philosophy a little bit here, I would argue that goodness is not a state of mind, goodness is a state of action. And again, I mean, we're sort of tripping into the whole Catholic good works versus Protestant justification by faith alone, I suppose. But I do think good works and good actions are essential to goodness. They cannot simply be a state of mind. Jane Seymour was said to be very politically conservative. She was said to be sympathetic to the monasteries and to the old religion. And crucially, she was said to be very sympathetic to her eldest stepdaughter, the Lady Mary Tudor. I would argue that in all three of those cases, even if Jane felt that way, she quite simply did not display it enough. As I've said, with her sympathy towards the rebels who were in favour of keeping the monasteries, Henry really told her that she couldn't be. But if we look at her actions as a stepmother to Mary, this idea that she was the good stepmother compared to Anne Boleyn, who had been the bad stepmother, kind of reduces both of them and Mary into being stock characters. The worst few months of Mary Tudor's life were after Anne Boleyn died. Sorry, just let me grab a drink. That's Diet Coke, by the way. It's not wine. I'm not drinking on the job. I'm cleaning all my other glasses. And also I look quite rosy-cheeked, so I'm quite worried people will think it's wine. I think, where was I before I looked like I was protesting too much? Mary. Yes. The worst few months of Mary Tudor's life were after Anne Boleyn was executed. She is put under unbearable psychological pressure, with the Duke of Norfolk and Thomas Cromwell acting as her father's henchmen. She is horrendously bullied into acknowledging the split with Rome, acknowledging her mother's divorce and her own illegitimacy. Jane Seymour lifts not one finger to help Mary until Mary has signed all those documents and she's back at court, when Jane gives her a diamond ring as a sign of her favour. Now, I'm sure everyone loves a diamond. Who wouldn't like an expensive piece of bling? But it was not handed to Mary until total political submission had been achieved. Let's not forget, Anne Boleyn offered Mary the earth. She offered her a lavish household. She offered her her favourite court. Anne probably would have showered Mary with favour, but Anne's conditions were the same as Henry's, and by an extension, Jane's. You must submit. So this leads me into my sort of final conclusion on Jane Seymour, as a woman and as a queen, from what we can tell. I think we are looking at a consummate and very sensible political survivor. I think this is someone who, like all of us, if we were put in a situation in which we were marrying someone who had executed their last spouse, who has divorced another, who has sent hundreds to their death by this stage, who wages a bloody policy of attrition and retribution on those who dared rebel against him in the north, I think we would choose the safer course of survival. And when it is possible for Jane to be kind, she is. She is with Mary, that lovely gift of the diamond ring, the signs of favour, her open affection to Mary. When it is within Jane's power to be kind, she is. When it is in her best interests, or when she is simply in a position where she has to be quiet and obey, she does so. She does not help Elizabeth, the Anne Boleyn's child. Elizabeth's governess is left writing to Cromwell saying, we don't have enough clothes to clothe her anymore and we don't have enough money to feed the household. Jane is nowhere to be seen. And I think because the stigma of Anne Boleyn's execution for treason, incest and adultery is still hanging over Elizabeth, Jane can't and therefore won't do anything. So coming to the end of looking at Jane Seymour, I would like to say that for me, she's not Strickland's villain, but she's also not the perfect stepmother. She's not the good queen that I think a lot of people are trying to make her, simply because she didn't do anything wrong. And I'd like to share a quote with you to sort of conclude this, from a biography that was written in the 30s. By a man called Stefan Weig. It's actually a very sad story. He was one of the victims of the Holocaust. And he wrote this in his biography of Marie Antoinette, but I don't think it applies. The biography is beautifully written, it's just not terribly accurate. I don't think it applies to Marie Antoinette, but I do think it applies quite fairly to how I've interpreted Jane Seymour, particularly after after writing this, and just my collar sort of splayed like some sort of Van Dyck painting. I'm so sorry. I would like to first of all thank you all so much for listening to this. And to Claire and Tim for asking me to do the talk. I've actually had so much fun thinking about Jane over the last few days. And to me, this quote from Stefan Zweig is the quote that sums her up best. This is my Jane Seymour. In this matter, as in most, truth lies somewhere near the middle. She was a mediocre, an average woman, not exceptionally able, nor yet exceptionally foolish, neither fire nor ice. Devoid of any vigorous wish to do good, but also of the remotest inclination to do evil. She was the average woman of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, lacking impulse towards the demonic, uninspired by the will to heroism. And I think that's a fair assessment. I think she was a survivor. I think she was dealt a difficult hand and she played it exceptionally well. Do I think she was a heroine? No. Do I think she was a bad woman? Absolutely not. Thank you very much.